Biden regime.
With draconian power, Savak set a reign of terror that lasted 2 years. Many were arrested, tortured, or even killed on the slightest charges. This era was one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern Iran.
در سال 55 رژیم شاه تصمیم داشت.
In 1976, the regime had decided to put in prison whoever showed the least opposition, thinking that in this way it could reduce the numbers of its opponents. این عمل میتونه تعداد مخالفینش رو کم کنه. به خاطر همین و به همین علت زندان. Therefore, the prisons of the Shah became overcrowded, that is, political prisons. At that time, the Castro prison and others were overcrowded.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
Experts say COVID school closures cost children one-third of a year's learning. So they say a sustained catch-up effort is needed to help students to recover lost skills and knowledge. Please stay with us for an exclusive article published in the scientific journal Nature. Stay tuned for more. Children lost out on more than one-third of a school year's worth of learning during the COVID-19 pandemic, an analysis has found. Their math skills were more affected than their reading abilities. The study published in Nature Human Behavior on January 30 shows that efforts to prevent further learning losses after the pandemic has been successful, but school-aged children have not caught up on the loss of knowledge and skills that they experienced at the start of the pandemic, during which school closures were widespread. This is going to be a real problem for this generation that experienced the pandemic in school, says Bastian Bosher, a sociologist at the University of Oxford and co-author of this study. If not addressed, these learning losses will affect this generation's success in the labor market, he adds. COVID-19 pandemic caused the largest disruption to education in history. 95% of the world's student population was affected by school closures. According to the UN Cultural Organization UNESCO, schools suspended in-person teaching for an average of 3.5 months during the pandemic. The authors screened 5,997 peer-reviewed papers and pre-printed studies on the pandemic's impacts on education. They looked at learning deficits, delays in learning progress, measured using test scores, as well as the loss of skills and knowledge that children already had before the pandemic. Their analysis included 291 learning deficit estimates, reported in 42 studies from 15 high- and middle-income countries, the United States, the UK, Australia, Belgium, Brazil, Denmark, Italy, Spain, Mexico, Sweden, Switzerland, South Africa, the Netherlands, Germany, and Colombia. The researchers calculated that, on average, school-aged children across all grades lost 35% of a school year's worth of learning during the pandemic, and that these learning gaps had not been recovered as of May 2022. The loss of skills was worse in math than in reading, possibly because parents were less able to help their children with math exercises, the researchers speculate. There are, however, some skills that children might have developed during the pandemic as a result of remote or hybrid teaching, says Luca Lusick, a psychologist at the Pratt Institute in New York City. Kids were getting super familiarized with the cyberspace and technological context and will, in the future, be much more native to the digital world. The learning slowdown during the pandemic was not just an outcome of school closures, but a combination of factors involving home learning environments. These include access to learning equipment, computers, digital sources, having a quiet room to work in, and economic insecurity amongst families, says Busher. The pandemic reinforced learning inequality at the global level, he said. There was a lack of data from lower-income countries, but the study found that children with more disadvantaged socioeconomic backgrounds in high- and middle-income countries have experienced larger learning losses. The authors predict that the pandemic's effects on learning will be more severe for children in poorer regions. Those students were suffering before the pandemic. They suffered more during the pandemic, and now, as we are trying to get our way out of this, they're going to receive less than others to recover, says Amanda Nitz, a researcher at Johns Hopkins University School of Education in Baltimore, Maryland. Researchers say policy initiatives to help children to recover lost learning and skills are urgently needed. This isn't going to be something that we watch up in a year or two. When everything is back to normal, I think this is going to be a decade long, Nisha said, adding, we need to rethink schooling and make substantial changes to the structure and way that we do education to make this up.
Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a new story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to commemorate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which culminated in the coming to power of the Islamic Republic in February 1979. And we're going to focus on the Islamic values that this revolution espoused, such as the necessity of governing Muslim societies by the laws of Allah and the need for Muslims worldwide to unite. But first, here's a report looking back at those momentous days in 1979.
On February 1st, 1979, millions of Iranians welcomed the return of their charismatic leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the imam who led a revolution which toppled an oppressive Western-backed regime and changed the course of history. Imam Khomeini's arrival to Tehran following 15 years in exile intensified months of popular protests against the Pahlavi regime. 10 days later, the rallies culminated in the downfall of the regime, ending the more than two millennia of monarchy in Iran. Imam Khomeini not only stood for Iranian self-determination, but pushed for Muslim unity, strength, and Islamic anti-imperialism, which the Muslim world had yet to see rise to a level which could effectively oust Western hegemony over Middle Eastern countries. The Islamic Revolution also established a new political system, a republic based on Islamic values and democracy. Since the revolution, the lives of Iranians have improved tremendously. Life expectancy has increased from 55 to 76%. Literacy rating risen from 47% to 96.6%. With a medical, sporting, and scientific ranking to rival the world's best and a powerful military which assists the region's struggle against terrorism and colonialism. Imam Khomeini's revolution proved that Muslims can win against the odds and Islam can work in a modern political setting.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Iran's revolution and its Islamic significance, I have Masoud Shajareh, who is the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission here in London, and also Sister Batul Subaiti, who is a political activist and commentator. Welcome to the show. Thank you both very much for coming on. Now, Masoud, I want to come straight to you because I was surprised to learn you appeared like a young man to me, but you apparently were around during that time and you may have some memories of the revolution, which I don't have, for example. Could you just tell us, what was it like to go through that period, the real revolutionary decade after the revolution took place?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I think it's very important to realize what was the environment just before the revolution in Iran, and indeed globally. Islam wasn't recognized as relevant to that time's people's political, social, economical sort of needs. It was seen as a fuddy-duddy sort of Eastern religion, which was something of the past and no relevant to the present. And that's on one side. And the other side, Iran was going through huge sort of difficulties, you know, the dictatorship of Shah and the fact that economically, politically, Iran was really bottom. And you know, the Shah was number one sort of agent and servant of the West. But it wasn't actually able to do anything for the ordinary Iranian people. There was such an unhappiness within Iran. And I remember going to Iran just a couple of years before. And when I came back, I was talking to everyone and saying, look, it's not going to go on like this. There's going to be a change. I didn't expect it to be so soon, but it was obvious that the situation in Iran cannot continue like that. You know, the poverty, the injustice, everything was so ripe. But what happened with the revolution was Ayatollah Khomeini brought the spirit of Islam as a revival, as a tsunami, not just for Iran, but the whole world. You know, even in South America, who weren't really followers of Islam by any definition, they were inspired by the revolution of Iran because it stood against the number one stooge of the United States, which was abusing his own people for the benefit of the that colonial power. And I think that was something which then, it was a tsunami. It affected the Palestinian movement. It affected the Islamic movement around the world. Mm. Islam was seen as a revival tool, an empowering tool, which could actually undermine the tyranny of the time.
Yes, we are going to speak more about the sort of ripple effect that the revolution had on the region, how it's helped other countries, other peoples as well. But Batul, I want to bring you in on this as well, because you perhaps represent a younger generation, of course, who perhaps look to the revolution still. Just tell me, what does the revolution mean to you, and what does it represent for you today?
Ultimately, to me, it represents dignity. It's a manifestation of the ayah from the Holy Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahim, kam min fa'atin qalilatin ghalabat fa'atin kathiratin bi'idhnillah. So how many times have an entity that's small in number and, let's say, a material strength has overcome an entity that's much larger in number and material strength by the way of God? So, of course, Islam is the determining factor, and it's the true identity for the people and for the society of Iran, which I think is something that really makes it stand out, is that Islam is not being used as a cover for the interests of those in power. In actual fact, Iran has had to basically let go of many short-term, you know, benefits or interests in pursuit of those higher objectives and in pursuit of those principles. And I see that Iran today in the region is probably the only country that's really standing as an obstacle to the Western imperialist project and has demonstrated that full hand. Not only is Iran stable today, but it's looking to create a new world order, one that that constitutes of respect, cooperation, growth, expertise. And look, it's been over four decades since the advent of the revolution. Its ideals are still very much within the hearts and minds of the Iranians, and I would say beyond. And I would say that for the younger generation, there's actually overpowering feelings. And we have to understand that this younger generation hasn't actually witnessed the revolution firsthand. It hasn't even witnessed the eight-year war. But look at the way that they, for example, commemorate their martyrs. You know, look at the way that today they commemorate the likes of Haj Qasem Soleimani. And this is all despite the soft war efforts to basically weaken and to target their faith. So we have to put it within that context. So I think that shows that the revolution has a dynamic understanding of the needs of the younger generation that are inherently attracted to it.
And of course, I think it's worth mentioning that Iran right now is facing a kind of Western pressure campaign. Mm-hmm. And in specific, they're focusing on things like the woman's rights in Iran. Yeah. Tell me, do you think that the Islamic Revolution has compromised on women's rights in Iran, or perhaps has empowered it, surprisingly, in another way?
I think the Islamic Revolution has actually taken away those factors that would otherwise abuse a woman, essentially. I mean, if you look at the West, for example, you see that a woman is viewed as both a consumer and a merchandise. She's viewed as a product that buys and sells, and her worth is only seen insofar as she generates capital and revenue. Whereas you see that actually one of the core moral values and structures is to focus on the family institution, strengthening the family institution. The role of a mother, for example, that she plays in terms of nurturing the future generations, that's something that's very much focused upon, and the value of a woman inherently and instinctively, as well as her participation in wider society. We see that, for example, the hijab is seen as an essential component to strengthen the family institution and to also facilitate the role of a woman in wider society. Imam Khomeini, you know, very famously, when he was speaking to a group of men, he told them, you know, do you think it is your speeches that have brought down the Shah? It is these very women. Treat them with honour. What he was saying was that these women were leading at the forefront of the protest movements. They were disseminating the education. They were disseminating the information within wider society. The only caveat that I would say was placed was that the hijab is the means and is the vehicle through which a woman can interact in society to maximize that productivity and that effort. So I would say actually the obstacles that would take away a woman's productivity and potential have been removed. And actually she's been respected and honored for the output that she gives to society, as well as her innate role that she plays as a mother and as a wife.
Well, that's really insightful. Thank you so much for sharing. And Masood, I want to ask you about the work that you've done here in the UK. It's been very much focused on, you know, bringing Sunnis and Shias and different Muslims from different backgrounds together to kind of achieve a joint objective towards empowering Muslims and so on. But that's also something which the Islamic Revolution has tried to achieve on a bigger regional level. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think the fact of the matter is that the Islamic Revolution was a reflection of what the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is. So when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Attasimu bihamdillahi jami'an," and orders you to come together, any Islamic movement has to put that as one of its sort of aims and objectives. You know, Islamic movements, so-called, who think they could go by creating fractions and grouping and, you know, theological sort of basis and ignore everyone else, it's going against that verses of Quran, and indeed against the concept of Islam. To unite, I mean, look, every Muslim and non-Muslim knows that for us to achieve our aspirations as Muslims, we need to unite. We need to come together for those issues. And indeed, we need to even unite with others other than Muslim for those issues. To be involved in sort of sectarianism and so forth, it actually is counterproductive to that. So it was absolutely essential for the Islamic movement and the Islamic Revolution to have that as one of his aims and objectives. And I think that's essential for any Islamic movement.
Yes, of course, sectarianism is a poison which has plagued the region for far too long. And it's great to see Absolutely. That there is a nation, the Islamic Republic, in the Middle East, which is fighting against that. However, before we continue this discussion, I want to bring in and remind ourselves of a particular Quranic verse, which is often associated with the Islamic Revolution. The verse in the fifth surah of the Quran tells us that Allah will always replace those who turn away from Him with people who are better and who will strive in the path of God, no matter how the disbelievers dislike it. Batul, I want to come back to you on this, because one thing which Iran has done very, very well since 1979 until now, which doesn't get nearly enough coverage, particularly in Western mainstream circles, is the effort that they've done to combat extremism, combat terrorism. In fact, Iran has played a huge role in defeating notorious terrorist groups like Daesh, for example, in Iraq. Perhaps you could elaborate on that a little bit more for us.
Absolutely. I think at the crux of it, Iran has an open hand policy. So that is every oppressed individuals, no matter what their background is, no matter what their religion is, no matter what system of governance they have in place, they will unite on the basis of causes and on the basis of those inherent values. So we see that, for example, when Iran had to fight, because Iraq had invaded essentially during the Iran-Iraq war, that did not stop it. The fact that the whole world was, you know, besieging and sanctioning Iran and all kinds of weapons and ammunitions were used against them, still then when they were at their lowest point in terms of material strength, did they still reach their hands out to the Palestinians to support them, essentially, in their fight against the occupation? It did the same thing in Lebanon. You know, Iran was crucial in the formation of Hezbollah and in their support, this Lebanese liberation group, which essentially defeated Israel in 2000 and drove them out. And Haj Qasem Soleimani is one of the individuals who is hailed as having a key role to play, essentially, in the imparting of the strategic, basically, advice and training that he had had. So ultimately, what it is that Iran has a vision. And that vision is that wherever there is oppression, that oppression needs to be uprooted. And that oppression is uprooted by giving the necessary support to those individuals on the ground and training them such that they can become self-sufficient to fight that enemy. You know, the overcoming of the enemy won't happen unless the individuals themselves on the ground want that to happen. So, for example, we see that even within the Palestinian liberation groups, they would train them how to create bullets, for example. They would train them how to create these tunnels. Rather than making them kind of dependent, they would seek to make them self-sufficient. And it sees the struggle as one united struggle against a greater enemy. So it's like Imam Khomeini defined America as the great Satan. So anyone that wants to support in weakening the hegemony of America, we will support in that pursuit. We will unite for that objective, essentially.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how nowadays you find that Iran has a relationship with many countries around the world who are not Muslim majority. Venezuela, for example, Iran has played a role in helping them. So, Masood, I'm going to come back to you because it seems to me as if you look at how Iran is now to how it was back before 1979... The misconception is that Islam removes human rights, that Islam is anti-education for women, that type of thing. But actually, surprisingly, women education is at an all-time high in Iran. Literacy level has improved since the revolution, that type of thing. And now Iran is a world competitor in the field of sciences, sport and so on. So perhaps you could elaborate on that point as well for us.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what the sister said regarding the saying of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, that women were instrumental in bringing the revolution. They were also the actual beneficiaries. They benefited a lot more than the men in as a result of the revolution. The number of sort of women at universities, the number of judges, the number of the lecturers and professors, and politicians, it really is not possible to compare it with Shah's time. You know, at the Shah's time, the freedom for the women was dependent on the inches of the skirts. You know, the higher it went, you know, there were more freedom. Well, here you could actually measure it by empowerment of women to take their rightful place. But also, I think Iran, although was the number one importer and buying weapons from United States, when the war took place, Iran was not capable, didn't have the resources, except the manpower and the dedication of the Mujahideen to actually defend itself. Now Iran is a regional power. And when you look at all the other technology, you see that Iran is number 5, number 4, number 7 in the world, despite all the sanctions and everything. I think what is really important is that we need to ask the question, why is it Iran being singled out with this sort of attack by global sort of West day in, day out? Is it really anything to do with the human rights, for example? You know, when we see the Saudis have actually given death penalty for someone for tweeting, and the world is completely silent, and then in Iran, someone gets death penalty for killing people in the demonstration in front of the international community and on the cameras, then there is a huge opposition. So we need to actually be able to have a filter to understand that, you know, what is going on. There are at the moment 127 channels beaming sort of Farsi into Iran. I mean, this is not economical. This has all been fabricated. This has all been organized. This is really a tool of trying to undermine a country which is not just standing for is independent, but also is the aid for all others, including Venezuela, including South America and elsewhere.
You've mentioned, of course, a kind of criticism campaign against the Islamic Republic that does exist. Criticism ranges from things like they claim it's a dictatorship, they claim that, you know, Iran is being expansionist and is trying to pursue some kind of Persian Empire building project in the Arab world, that type of thing. How would you respond to this type of criticism? What would you say about it?
You know, I mean, look at forget the spins. Look at the reality. Look at the statistic. Look at the history. Iran hasn't invaded any country, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, Iran has actually, as the sister said, helped and support others to be able to empower themselves against one of the greatest atrocities against them, like the Palestinians, like the Lebanese, like Venezuela. You know, it really is not even there to sort of colonize everywhere else. It's there to help and support, despite the fact that itself is under huge pressure, a pressure
sanctions. Batul, I want to bring you in because we haven't got a lot of time left before the end of the show. Again, I want to give you a chance to respond to some of the criticism. Other criticisms include, for example, that it's a revolution for Shia Muslims. You know, this is a Shia Muslim majority country. It's ultimately for them only. That's their main interest. How would you respond to that?
I just want to respond to the thing before that, and that is on the point of dictatorship. And it is that Iran is a very active and energetic nation. So in 1979, the whole world was seeking to crush this revolution. That was the whole point of the eight-year war. That's the whole point of the economic sanctions that we're seeing today, that Iran has turned from a challenge to an opportunity. So essentially, for someone to come and to say that it's a dictatorship, okay, Iran right now is being sanctioned for this revolution. Who is maintaining this revolution? What is its support base? Its support base is the people, because where else is it going to get that support? It doesn't have any kind of foreign support. And if you look at the inherent institutions within Iran, they're in such a way that they rest on the people. They're made up of the masses of the people. And they're designed to monitor each other. For example, just take the IRGC, the Besiege, for instance, these different institutions. So if today, if really and truly the Iranian nation today did not want an Islamic Republic, and the world is telling Iran that if you get rid of this Islamic Republic, we will remove these sanctions away from you, it doesn't make sense to say that the people in Iran actually are not happy and want to remove the system. Yes, they have their criticisms. Of course, they have their criticisms like in any other country. But what actually the people in Iran are asking for is for the government to get closer to the Islamic ideals. It's to get closer to the models. They have a problem with the reformist ideologies that is, you know, bringing about more of a neoliberal model. That's the kind of internal critique. A lot of internal criticism happens not to remove the Islamic component. It's like, oh, this revolution is meant to be based on full social justice. So we want to see more of that being enacted within internal policies. And of course, Iranians are very, very smart and politically aware and read. So they're aware of what the external reality is like. They're aware of the machinations of the enemy, essentially. And in terms of this question about it being, you know, Shias, I think, like Brother Masoud was saying, reality speaks for itself. If Iran is going out, if Imam Khomeini went out of his way to cut ties with South Africa because of the apartheid, if Iran goes out of its way to be the only entity to ship oil and fuel to Venezuela that's under the same sanctions for the same pretext that Iran is in, and that is because it's trying to carve out its own trajectory in its own line. If Iran goes out of its way to support the Palestinian Liberation Group like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Haj Qasem Soleimani even himself stressed that we don't give weapons and support on the basis of whether you are Sunni, whether you are Shia, what your background is. You either surrender to the enemy or you face the enemy. That is ultimately what determines whether we will be supporting you or it's futile, essentially.
Unfortunately, Batul, we are out of time, but I think you've summarised your point very, very effectively. And to you, Sir Masoud, thank you to you both for joining me, and thank you for everyone at home for tuning in as well. But don't worry, next week we'll be back for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Salaamu Alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
According to economic analysts, the rise in prices and interest rates in the United Kingdom has now become a common concern for many Britons. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story. According to a survey, two-thirds of British consumers are planning to cut their discretionary spending in 2023 amid concerns about the cost of living crisis. Highlighting the pressure on families and the wider economy from inflation, the accountancy firm KPMG said 61% of consumers in a poll of 3,000 were preparing to reduce their spending on eating out, holidays and other non-essentials. The survey found concerns over the cost of basic items such as food, energy, fuel and mortgage or rent costs, as well as worries over how much further these could rise, were the biggest deterrents for discretionary spending. With inflation above 10% for the first time since the early 1980s, households across Britain have tightened their belts to accommodate soaring gas and electricity bills and the rising cost of weekly shopping, prompting the Bank of England to warn about a lengthy recession. Official forecasts show sky-high inflation will erode average real pay and cut living standards by 7% over the 2 years to the end of March 2024, wiping out the previous 8 years of growth. Highlighting the uneven impact for some families, the KPMG survey showed 1 in 10 adults have no savings. Only 4% said they would be able to increase their non-essential spending levels in 2023, while a quarter would stay at their 2022 level. Of these with savings, 43% said they were using them to help meet essential costs. This rises to more than 80% among some low-income households, reflecting the disproportionate impact of living costs on poorer families. 1 in 10 consumers highlighted concern about energy bills after April, when the government will reduce the amount of support available to families by increasing the cap on average bill from £2,500 to £3,000 for a typical household. Consumers also cited the end of fixed-term mortgage deals as well as variable-rate mortgages as barriers to their spending. KPMG said a third of consumers in Britain plan to buy more own brand and value products in 2023, while a third would buy fewer items altogether. The most common areas for saving on discretionary spending were eating out, 46%, clothing, 42%, takeaways, 42%. Linda Ellett, UK Head of Consumer Markets, Retail and Leisure at KPMG, said current essential costs, fears of how high they'll rise, including concerns about mortgage rates and energy price changes next year, are all factors in why two-thirds of consumers that we surveyed said they have to reduce their non-essential spending in 2023. British newspaper The Express has also covered the same story. Amid the worsening cost of living crisis this winter, new research revealed a large proportion of households in Britain are worried about losing their income at some point over the next year. Crippling housing costs have long been one of the main engines of homelessness in Britain, but soaring energy bills and record rents mean more people than ever now find themselves at risk. In order to stave off this most severe of outcomes, many have been cutting back on spending over the holidays. According to a new survey by Beam, a social impact startup helping refugees and homeless people find work and housing, 35% of people in Britain believe they're at risk of becoming homeless in 2023. Conducted in November, these fears reflect escalating concern over rising prices generally. Britain's inflation came in at 10.7% last month, only a slight fall back from the 42-year record high of 11.1% in October. Energy prices have been the main driver of inflation throughout the year, pushing up the cost of heating and using electricity for households to untenable levels, just as the winter cold sets in. Research by the International Monetary Fund, published in September, found the poorest 10% of households in Britain would be spending 17.8% of their income on energy alone in 2022. Reflecting this, just under half of the Beam survey's respondents said their housing costs have increased by as much as 22% in the past 6 months, while 32% reported worrying that costs will continue to go up over the next 6 months. The same proportion, about 32%, reported they were concerned they wouldn't be able to cover their housing costs in the near future. If costs were to rise beyond what they could afford and they'd lost their home, a quarter of Britons polled confessed they would have nowhere else to go and would be forced to live on the streets. According to the charity Crisis, homelessness can result from a loss of job, the breakdown of a relationship, or the onset of physical or mental health problems. However, the claim the most common cause is no longer being able to afford housing costs. In the year to March, a total of 133,460 families were affected by homelessness in England, the latest report from the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, an 11.3% increase on the previous year. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. The cost of living crisis is affecting people's retirement plans, with millions of workers across the country deciding to cut back on their pension contributions to help pay for rising food and energy costs. New research from the Pensions Management Institute, PMI, found that in the past year, people have abandoned payments into their retirement funds to keep hold of £550 or more as high interest rates continue to bite. The research body found abandoning such savings could delay employees' plans to pack in work by 3 years, with 28% of those surveyed believing they will never be able to retire. It comes as millions of Britons face a surprise hike in energy bills from 1st of January, as the economic crisis continues to deepen. According to the Pensions Management Institute, PMI, 20% of staff have opted out of their workplace's pension scheme or asked for their contributions reduced over the last year. A further 20% are considering taking similar steps to create some extra cash to use now. By axing their pension contributions each month, those on low salaries of £20,000 a year can boost their take-home pay by around £550 a year. Those higher earners, therefore, will be able to increase their take-home each month even further. However, avoiding pension payments means that employees would miss out on their employer's tax relief, resulting in less being saved for their later years. The Pensions Management Institute, PMI, surveyed 2,000 employees in November and found that 7% had taken a decision to opt out in the last 12 months. A further 13% asked to reduce their pension contributions, meaning they would miss out on parallel contributions from their employer, with a further 20% considering ceasing funding their pension pots. The number of savers feeling impact of the ongoing cost of living crisis was 40%, with three-quarters of employees having considerable concerns that the current economic crisis would have a detrimental effect on their retirement plans.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan. Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoners' Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gvir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that the tension in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held under administrative detention, in which Israel keeps the detainees without charge for up to 6 months, a period which can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. Rights groups describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end this move.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at the illegal detentions. Israeli jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression.
The U.S. announced on January 25th that it will send 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. The tanks may take months or even years to arrive and may never see the battlefield. The M1 Abrams is the main battle tank of the U.S. military and is one of the most powerful and sophisticated tanks in the world. But for Ukraine, that is both the advantage and the problem. In his comments announcing the decision, U.S. President Joe Biden said that delivering the tanks to Ukraine will take time without further specification.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
Military analysts say it could take a year or more for all these Abrams to make it to Ukraine. So any expectations that these tanks will have an immediate impact on the fighting needs to be tempered. The tanks will be purchased from General Dynamics, the manufacturer of the tank. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said it will take many months for General Dynamics to build them. Kirby said the U.S. doesn't have the extra tanks in its arsenal, and even if there were excess tanks, it would still take many months, suggesting that the unbuilt tanks will take even longer to arrive. While the estimated timeline suggests that the tanks cannot have an immediate impact on the conflict, it seems that may never have been the intention. The decision may have been more strategic and diplomatic than military. The Biden administration made the decision against the advice of the Pentagon. The tank the U.S. really wants on the battlefields of Ukraine is the German Leopard 2. But Germany was never going to send them without the cover of the U.S. agreeing to send their tanks. In case there was any doubt, on January 19th, at the World Economic Forum, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz privately but very directly told the U.S. delegation that Germany was not going to send their tanks until the U.S. agreed to send theirs. The U.S. may never have intended the Abrams tanks for the current war. They may not even be the right tanks for this war. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley had both recommended against sending M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. In addition to how long it takes to train personnel to operate the tanks and how difficult the tanks are to maintain, they have also said that the Abrams tanks are not the right vehicles for the fight in Ukraine right now. By promising to send the tanks without ever specifying a delivery date, the U.S. may have succeeded in giving Germany and Europe cover to send their Leopard tanks without ever actually sending U.S. tanks onto the current battlefield. Most NATO members in Europe have kept open the possibility of sending their F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, even as U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would not do so. Air defense experts say U.S.-built F-16 fighter jets would offer Ukraine an edge over the Russian Air Force, but only if combined with powerful missiles and targeting information which the West would also have to provide, drawing it more actively into the war. There are clear advantages to the F-16. It is the world's most produced fighter jet, with many being decommissioned in Europe as NATO members transition to the F-35. Lockheed Martin, which produces the F-16, told the Financial Times it can increase production to replace planes sent to Ukraine. But there are practical and symbolic concerns. Experts say training Ukrainian pilots on F-16s might not be carried out in time to make a difference in the war this year. Also, bringing in Western pilots, even as privateers, could create political complications. Ukraine has reportedly prepared a batch of 50 pilots who have flown in Western military exercises and could be trained in 3 months. The symbolic concern is over losses of aircraft. Russia's development of hypersonic missiles could prove a match for the F-16, ending the narrative of NATO superiority. Perhaps for such reasons, there are still naysayers in the Western alliance. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, after bowing to pressure to send Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine, said he would not be sending the jets. The West, the U.S. in particular, has supplied Ukraine with arms and munitions worth billions of dollars since the beginning of the war in February last year. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently doubled down on the need for new weapons from his Western backers to counter Russia's military advances, urging the West to send long-range missiles and fighter jets in addition to tanks.
We have to open the supply of long-range missiles to Ukraine, and it is important that we expand our cooperation in artillery, and we have to start supplying aircraft to Ukraine. This is our dream and our task.
Russia has frequently warned that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only prolong the war.
We
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial